So, as most of you know, this month at our various sits and groups, we're exploring a really juicy topic. And it's right or wise livelihood. So, it really has a lot to do with our work life. And wise livelihood falls within the ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path. So this year we're exploring the Four Noble Truths, the heart of the Buddhist teaching that is really concerned in overarching ways and really specific ways about concerned with suffering and its end. So the Eightfold Path really invites us, kind of asks us, to kind of shine the light of awareness on these different aspects of our lives and see what we can discover in terms of suffering and its end, in terms of ways that we may be intentionally and often unintentionally contributing to harm. But also ways in which we may be intentionally and sometimes unintentionally cultivating or contributing to the easing or the alleviation of harm. So in this month of exploring livelihood, we're really examining work. Our relationship to work, which is wonderfully fraught for almost all of us, or all of us perhaps at some point. And I gave a talk to the under 40ers a couple of weeks ago and concluded that I think we could spend a whole year on livelihood. It's such a big question, and it's often fraught because in it, how we kind of make a living, that art of making a living, calls into question how we create an identity, questions of identity, often for us, who we think we are, who we think others are, is very tied to the work that we do. I have a couple of friends who refuse to ask the question, "What do you do?" when meeting people, because often it's kind of a question of like, how good are you, right? Instead, they ask, "How do you spend your time? How do you spend your days?" So anyway, I'll talk a little bit more about our concepts of work as we go. But this question of livelihood is often fraught, because so many of our identity perceptions around identity come into question. Also, a lot of our survival needs for many of us. How do we survive? How do we get our basic needs met? So for many of us, those are our front and center. It's less about is our work meaningful and more does it can I provide for my basic needs for myself and often others. And then also it's a bit fraught because we're participating in a sort of capitalist system in which the overarching value is profit. Yeah. Right. So even if we are in ethical organizations, that take care of people, provide them with a living wage, we're part of a wider framework in which the primary value is profit. So how do we participate in that in a way that is conscious, aware, deliberate? And even by virtue of just, paying taxes, what we support with our money, with our resources. We can sense, many of us can sense how we are unintentionally, but perhaps very clearly contributing to harm in various ways. So livelihood is really tricky, and in many ways, I think the question is not how do we completely eliminate harm, but how do we make it conscious? How do we reduce it? And how do we, is it possible to cultivate a relationship with work so that we're working with harm and suffering consciously, intentionally? So in another teaching of the Buddha's, there is a wheel of dependent origination, it's called. And this is the wheel of how we so easily and habitually get trapped into suffering. And there are various links and aspects to that wheel, but there's also a wheel of transcendent dependent origination. And so this is a map that kind of highlights a lawful process by which we step out of mind that is habituated towards forgetting, towards getting, towards consuming, and towards resistance and often various forms of hatred or pushing away. So in this second map, instead of suffering leading to a cycle of more suffering, suffering as we recognize it and bring awareness to it actually gives rise to faith or confidence. And so it is possible when we recognize and bring awareness to suffering that instead of it leading towards more resistance, despair, doubt, it can actually lead to a kind of confidence. Ah, this too is part of practice. This too has the potential to be brought to the path. This too has the possibility of learning, evolving, transforming. So in that way, this is such a fruitful territory to be exploring because of its complexity, because the potential for dukkha is so strong. And this is another question I asked the under 40 years. How much of the kind of tension and stress, dukkha that you're aware of has to do with work on a daily basis? So you might just float this question, perhaps over time, over decades, over a life, how much of the stress that we carry has to do with work? Work, again, is a place where identity can come into bear. It's also a place where we spend a good deal of time and where interpersonal dynamics are often rife with conflict. Yeah? There's often time pressures, performance pressures. So this is a wonderful place of exploration. So tonight I'll talk a little bit about what we do. So the Buddha was really clear, laid out really specifically what wise livelihood is in terms of what we refrain from. But as we know, in terms of ethics, it's not just about refraining. It's also about cultivating. So we'll talk a little bit about what we do, and I know others have touched on this a lot this month, But more than that, it's kind of how we do what we do, or what we're cultivating as we're engaged in work. So the areas that the Buddha was very clear in terms of what we should refrain from are essentially extensions of the precepts. So the precepts are five categories of action in which humans tend to cause and contribute to a lot of suffering for themselves and others. So, and the essence of the precepts is a commitment to non-harming, right? So we consider the other as a living being who, just like us, does not want to be harmed, does not want to be deceived, manipulated, lied to, confused, and so on. So the precepts ask that we refrain from overt killing, from taking what hasn't been given, from causing harm with our speech, from causing harm with our sexuality, and from intoxicating ourselves so that we become heedless. So we extend the precepts to the workplace with right livelihood or wise livelihood, and the Buddha's encouragement or caution is, to the extent that we're able, to not profit from someone else's harm, to not earn our livelihood based on harming another. So these are the five specific kinds of livelihood in which we are to avoid. So to avoid kind of making one's living or profiting from engaging in businesses that deal in weapons, in living beings, which includes raising animals for slaughter, as well as dealing in people, so slave trade, prostitution, in meat production and butchery, in poisons, and in intoxicants. So there are all sorts of kind of, there are nuances even within those five, but essentially we're committing to not sustaining ourselves at the expense of others. And we can feel, as we become more sensitive with practice, that when we do this, this has an effect, a reverberation that not only affects the kind of web that we're a part of, but also has an effect that we can feel. So it's to really give a careful kind of attention to how we make a living, like the specifics of it. So the Buddha also said that he wasn't against earning wealth. He wasn't against making money. So that exhortation or that encouragement is that if we are making money, that we're offering it, that we're using it generously. So he wasn't against using our capacities to earn money, but then to use what we earn in a skillful way, in a generous way. So I'd like to frame this talk as a series of questions, a couple of questions that we can ask ourselves around livelihood. And the first just goes right to the heart of the Four Noble Truths, and that where is there harm in terms of my livelihood, how I'm earning a living, making a living? And this requires quite a bit of steadiness, right? Quite a bit of honesty. We don't assume that there isn't harm. We don't assume that we're some kind of ideal of perfection, but where is there harm? And for many of us, there will be some ways in which we're making a living, in which we're inevitably contributing to harm and can reduce that harm. But for many of us, a lot of the harm comes in how we are doing what we're doing, right? The way that we are with work. So I'll talk about that a little bit also. To ask this question takes quite a bit of courage and quite a bit of commitment to clear seeing. So one way that the Buddha also encouraged wise or right livelihood was the sense of balance. So a balanced livelihood. Said again, in terms of earning money, to be not miserly, but not extravagant. Right? To be not miserly, but not extravagant. Is it possible to meet our basic needs in a way that supports the well-being of others as well as ourselves? So that's another ongoing question. Yeah. Is it possible to meet our basic needs in a way that supports the well-being of others as well as ourselves? So I've lived in various forms of intentional communities over the years that have experimented with different economies, not based so much on profit, but based on providing for the basic needs for as many people as possible. So in one experiment, in a community I lived in India, all work was created equal. So whether you worked in food service, or whether you were a medical professional, or whether you worked for the newspaper, all work was created equal. And work was quite a complicated and elaborate system, but people would offer their work and in exchange would make sure that their basic needs, food, shelter, clothing, were met in an ongoing way. And of course, as all alternate models require, necessitated a huge amount of discussion and organization and labor to set up something different. And so we had discussions that lasted years in terms of what actually is a basic need. What is a basic need? Yeah. How much clothing do we need to have that particular need met? How much food? How much dessert? You know, what is a basic need? So just to say that these are really deep and often complex questions, balancing our own needs with the needs of the community or the whole. That's a huge question. So often our tension, the tension that we experience at work, is feeling that this balance is somehow off. And the Buddha said that, you know, no one path factor ever exists alone. So right view, right effort, and right mindfulness run in circle around right livelihood. Right view, right effort, and right mindfulness run in circle around right livelihood. So we're always modulating, how am I holding this? What is my perspective on this situation? Yeah, where am I coming from? What is my orientation? Am I aware? Am I mindful? Am I clear with what's happening, clear about what's happening? And how am I using my effort? So all of these contribute to right or wise livelihood. So those first questions are around where is there harm in my relationship to work? Yeah, either in what I'm doing, how I'm holding it. How do I balance, or do I experience a tension in the balance of meeting my basic needs versus perhaps the needs of a community, of the whole? And the third aspect, or the third question, has a lot to do with, as I said, has a lot to do with view. So how we view work. So it's easy for work to helpful to just hold that question. How do we actually view work? What is our relationship to it? Often, as I said in the beginning, work can feel like a means to an end, can feel like something that we have to do, are required to do. Some of us feel as though we have kind of found a spot in work, a relationship with work, where maybe it doesn't require as much of us. We're kind of on automatic pilot. But there's also the sense of perhaps we're not able to give our gifts as fully as we would like, or as fully as we're able to in terms of work. I read the journalist David Brooks once write that our relationship to work often is kind of like we used to relate to finding the perfect relationship, kind of that fairy tale ideal that we would someday, many of us have this, someday find the perfect partner that would complete us for all time, right? And slowly as we mature, hopefully we realize that is unlikely. But many of us take this into work, that if I could just find the perfect work situation, for perfect constellation of conditions, that I would feel completely satisfied, fulfilled, purposeful. But often it's not so much changing. Sometimes it's changing the external conditions of work, but more often it's changing our perspective and how we hold it. I know for me, early in my practice, I experienced a profound shift right as I began deepening in my practice in my early 20s. And I've talked about this in various ways, but it was almost like a collapse of effort in which the effort to kind of accomplish or get ahead or kind of produce or achieve for its own sake kind of burned out. And as I was spending more and more time on retreat devoted to practice, the only kind of work that made sense, and I'm not saying that this is true for everyone, it's certainly not, it's not some right way to be, but the only kind of work that felt sustaining was work in which I was directly in service to others, directly caring for others. So for me, this took the form of direct caregiving, so taking care of people who could no longer support themselves, various service jobs. And in those jobs, I felt as though it was just such a natural extension of my Dharma practice. There was never any ethical, I never felt much of a kind of ethical tension about how I was using my attention, energy, and resources. And it was as though my full-hearted presence was required in order to be good at my job. So it felt like it was growing the capacities that I wanted to grow. And it was through those efforts that I could, in doing that, it was really like stepping completely out of a cultural paradigm that valued productivity, efficiency, money making. So much to this created a lot of upset for the people around me who were invested in me being successful in a certain way that they recognized. So just to say that when we kind of expand our relationship to work, that this is not an easy process. To live in accordance with our values can look very different for different people, but we're not often rewarded for this. So one of the first kind of shifts that we can encourage is to really expand what our notion of work is beyond that which is compensated well financially. So as anybody who spent more than a couple of hours with a young child knows that the various forms of care that we do for one another are part of our livelihood. They are part of our work, and it's so often not recognized or valued. So we tend to discount it as valuable inside. I know I did. So I would often say to people, I was just meeting for the first time, that I'm a caregiver. That's what I do for work. And people would respond in all sorts of ways. I remember getting my hair cut once and saying that that was what I did for my livelihood. That's how I spent my days. And someone said, "Oh, so you spend days wiping butts." So it can be very devalued by the culture. So we can tend not to recognize it. So extending our notion of work. And since becoming a parent, I've noticed that my framework for what is work has completely shifted. And what I consider livelihood is completely shifted. There will always be tension if I separate my kind of paid work life with my home work life. So if I expand my notion to include all of the ways in which I offer my attention, my energy, my care, and my resources, if I expand my notion of work to include all of that, then my life, my days, become much more about offering than they do about a transaction. I do this so that I get that. Yeah. And that's the whole model. Yeah. From a transactional model to a caregiving model or a Dana model. So that means that my doing the dishes, my doing the laundry, my shuttling of kids, my attending to the house becomes part of my livelihood and becomes an important part of how I offer in the world, part of my work in the world. So a big part of that is recognizing, and I spoke to this in the guided sit, recognizing our giftedness. Recognizing our giftedness. Recognizing that our attention, our energy, our inner resources, as well as our financial resources, are gifts. They're not possessions of ours. They're gifts. And so how we offer them changes dramatically when we recognize them as gifts. Expanding our notion. So a lot of people think that moving into a wiser relationship with livelihood, or moving from wrong livelihood to right livelihood, unwise livelihood to wise livelihood, means making a dramatic change. And sometimes it does in what we're doing. Sometimes I meet with a lot of people individually, and a lot of times, people are contemplating how to make major changes in their lives so that what they do is more in alignment with what they value. So I often joke that we could probably have several spiritual friendship groups, several Kalyanamitta groups devoted to people who are trying to change livelihoods. Yeah, who are trying to get out of jobs that no longer serve or support their deepest well-being or that of those around them, and into something that feels more in alignment. So I know several of you are in those positions. But also, in addition to that, we can shift our relationship to one in which, yes, our basic needs are being met, but also that we're kind of recognizing our fundamental kind of giftedness, and our work becomes more about offering as best we can, as fully as we're able, without that kind of transactional mindset, in which I will only offer if I can be assured of getting that back in return. So this is more of the Dana model, and I wasn't these talks go in all sorts of different directions, but I wound up contemplating Dana as part of this contemplation on work. Possibility of, even if we're charging for our services, even if we are still in that transactional model to some degree, our inner mindset can shift to one of really feeling that we have something to offer and doing that fully. So there's a wonderful book, I'm sure I've mentioned it in talks before, by Lewis Hyde, a sociologist. It's called The Gift. And it talks a lot about gift economies and different forms of economic models, different ways in which people are able to offer their gifts, offer their art, offer their service, and contribute in a way that is helpful for the whole, a wider number of people, and sustaining to them. And He talks about this as really recognizing this sense of gift. And often there's a sense of gratitude that comes along with that. And so many people experience this as part of their deepening Dharma practice, right? A sense of, I have been offered so much, gifted so much. So Lewis Hyde says, an abiding sense of gratitude moves a person to labor in an abiding sense of gratitude moves a person to labor as an act of service. The opposite of this is perhaps properly called narcissism. The narcissist feels his gifts come from himself. He works to display himself, not to suffer change. This may be an age in which no one sacrifices according to his gifts. This is an age of narcissism. So without returning our gifts, without offering, the spirit cannot be fully free. So this is, again, a completely alternate paradigm than what most of us are used to. So more, of a service model, a giving model, a caregiving model in which we value a relationship, certain kind of relationship over a product. Offering instead of transaction. And we can hold this view or hold this perspective while we're, doing the dishes, doing the laundry, sending an email, doing our taxes. Right? It has so much to do with how we hold it. What we do need to, and this is, I want to just offer a little bit about this at the end, because as we switch models, and I think many of us are in the act of kind of transforming our models to some degree, if we're in the transactional model, we're always kind of in a sense of lack. The consumer transactional model always sets up a sense of lack. Never enough. I've got to get more. I've got to buy more. I've got to be more. I've got to do more. And it's never enough. That's how the whole thing goes around. But if we recognize that our practice almost invites us to the exact opposite of that, it is a revolutionary act, a profound shift. But our questions then become much more about how do I not burn out? Right? How do I not burn out? So this is loops back to my first question, and where is there tension in my relationship to work? Where is there suffering? Where does it feel as though I am extending beyond my capacities? Yeah. So all of the resources that I mentioned, attention, energy, effort, all of our resources also have limits. So to know our own limits and capacities. So Mushim Patricia Aikida, a wonderful Zen practitioner, offers this vow not to burn out, right? Which I love. And it's it goes along with the Bodhisattva vow, which is another way of talking about an attitude to work that I've been describing, in which we're offering we're really serving the well-being of others as much as possible. And we'll get confused and frustrated and forget, but just coming back to that intention. But if that is our orientation and approach, that in order to continue to offer, to continue to be circulating our gifts, we need to vow not to burn out. This is a huge act of service. So this is what she said, and she often gives this to activists that she's working with. So, aware of suffering and injustice, I, and then you say your name, am working to create a more just, peaceful, and sustainable world. I promise, for the benefit of all, to practice self-care, mindfulness, healing, and joy. I vow not to burn out. So she writes, as the people with disabilities in my Sangha have often said, in order to practice on behalf of all of us, there needs to be a radical shift towards an embodied practice of all of us or none of us. In other words, no one can be left behind on the sinking ship, not even those who want to self-martyr. Why? Because self-martyrdom is bad role modeling. Right? So, I love this. Burnout and self-sacrifice, the paradigm of the lone hero who takes nothing for herself and gives everything to others, injure all of us who are trying to bring the Dharma into everyday lay life through communities of transformative well-being, where the exchange of self for other is re-envisioned as the care of self in service to the community. The longer we live, the healthier we are, the happier we feel, the more we can gain the experience and wisdom needed to contribute toward a collective reimagining of relationships, work, education, and play. So many of us can feel a great need around us, in our families, in our communities, in our wider world. There's an endless need. And once we shift from this transactional model to a more Dana or caregiving model, it is imperative that we start to measure our own capacities and respect our own limits and find ways of regenerating and replenishing ourselves. So we give according to our capacities. We're not meant to do everything and be everything to all people. And it takes extraordinary discernment, again and again, to discern what is ours to do, what we can skillfully and wholeheartedly do. So I've turned down over the years, I've turned down a lot of very good invitations, to a lot of teaching, and have neglected a lot of very important emails in order to tend to the living, breathing kid that is right in front of me, or now the living, breathing dog who's right in front of me, who's now lonely. Now I have to deal with the dog who's lonely if he's neglected. But also to aging family members. And so it is valuing both a wider scope of work and also recognizing that we cannot be all things to all people at all times. We have to be very discerning with how we use our attention and our energy. As Leonard Cohen said, we have to forget our perfect offering. If we're committed to offering, we forget our perfect offering. Give according to our capacity and know how to replenish ourselves. So, as I was writing this, we live right next to two preschools. And so I'm writing this, thinking about work, thinking about the effort that we make in work, how we hold it. And kids are playing, the sound of kids playing outside is in the background almost all day during this time of year, because I can hear the playgrounds next to me. And the wonderful part of the preschool age is that it's so clear, at least it's more and more clear now, that we learn through play. We learn through curiosity, through exploration, through getting it wrong, and through play. So as grown-ups, we've often forget this. So my son's preschool teachers said, how do you learn about concrete? You fall on it. We learn about it. We learn about our limits by overextending and feeling completely spent and burned out. Yeah. We learn about our capacities, our minds, by using them, by learning about them, by playing, experimenting, getting it right, getting it wrong. So being willing to do this, even in the areas that feel so like there's so much at stake in terms of identity and risk and not fulfilling every need. So many of us who are drawn to various forms of helping often have to really examine this identification with the role of the helper, yeah, the one who helps, not the one who receives help, but the one who helps. So we have to look at that too as a place where tension and seriousness accumulate. Okay, so I hope this has given a little bit of fruitful terrain for your own exploration. I did not intend to veer in a Donna direction, but it's so good. It is such a good model. It is meant to, Donna means generosity, for those who don't know, and we can all live according to Donna to some degree. But it starts with recognizing our own giftedness, our own resources, and recognizing what we can offer. So in this way, we really can have the experience working within our own capacities of joyfully offering. Yeah, joyfully offering. So the giving is also a receiving. And there is a particular kind of joy in that, feeling the support of someone else's well-being, the community's well-being, and your own as a part of that. Hey, thank you, everybody. Appreciate your attention. Hope some of this was useful. So I'd love to see if there are a few questions, comments, your own reflections. Yeah.
I like that you mentioned this idea of work as something that we see as like, you know, finding the perfect romantic partner. It's like, yeah, we are kind of like sold that story, right? Where you're going to find something that you're passionate about and it's going to be like amazing. And because we spend so much of our lives like doing it.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about the balance of, you know, finding something that's good, but not this like perfect ideal, and letting go maybe of this perfect ideal.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could speak more to that. Like,
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, in our teacher training, Jack Kornfield made a comment because we were all talking about sustaining ourselves as Dharma teachers and Dana. And he said, you know, there's this idea that you do what you love and the money will follow. He said, well, maybe. No, maybe. So, yes, we are kind of sold the story often that if we find just the right thing, everything will click and fall into place. But I think sort of stepping out of that story, we can start to value that that sense of alignment. And maybe it is just kind of good enough, but maybe that we value that more than some kind of big, like dramatic payoff where this is going to, you know, fulfill all my deepest needs for contribution and expression and creativity. And for all of us with our work, there are areas in which it's likely skillful and supportive and areas where it's not. And just like with every relationship, you know, there are going to be areas where it's really supportive and there are areas where we will be bringing that to the path and we have some work to do. So if we conclude every time something difficult arises in a workplace that maybe we need to, you know, find a different place or it's not quite right, then we'll miss a lot of opportunities to work within the framework that we have. So often I'm really encouraging that with people to at first really try to work within the situation that you have as good enough, but good enough not so that you kind of resign yourself to it and put your head down, kind of go to sleep for a couple decades, but good enough so that I can practice with this. I can bring it all. Yeah. So, thank you. Okay, is it Carolyn? Sorry, I need my glasses to see. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Yes, so I have three different jobs, and I'm pretty clear that two of them are right lively. They fit under right livelihood. I help people, so it's pretty clear. But my other job is just about making money, and I'm wondering how that fits.
Yeah, great.
And I'm also thinking about, as I make money with this job, it depends on what I want to do with that money.
That's it.
So.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And that's, I mentioned the Buddha talked about, you know, he wasn't against making money. He was often talking to people who had accumulated a lot of money in various trades and had accumulated resources and wealth, different kinds. And he was just offering them to use it wisely, you know, to, again, not be miserly, but not be extravagant. And we can do a lot of good with money. We can support a lot of the people around us. We can, it's so much about the attitude, how we hold it and how we use it. As a driving force for the work that we do, you know, making money in and of itself, that we'll notice that mind is not a contented mind. That is kind of a consumer, more greed-based mind. But making money and using it wisely, generously, wholeheartedly, not at the expense of others, mm-hmm. not in a way that exploits or manipulates. But that there's that allows us to offer and support others can be very wholesome. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that feel right to you? Does that jive with your experience? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does, because I do feel fine about it, but it's just such a different way of earning money.
Yeah.
It's But yeah, as long as I'm doing good things without money, I think it's fine. That sounds
So
okay.
these are questions we can refresh over and over again. Yeah. It's like with all of these inquiries, especially around harm, it's not like we kind of look into it once and then, yeah, that's okay. And then don't look at it again, right? Where the Buddha really recommended this quality of, appamatta, which is, can be translated as heedfulness or care. So to be really interested, okay, what's going on in my mind with this? Yeah. In what ways is this harmful? Yeah. In which ways is this contributing? And it's almost always a mix, but to be aware, interested in those nuances and details. It's never usually either just this or just that. Maybe sometimes. But not, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Karen.
Thank you so much for this talk. I just wanted to bring up something. It's greater than 12 years ago that I went up to one of the teachers. It was Steve, and I was bitching about work and how I was going to work it out by staying with the issues with work because I'm in a helping profession. And I was bitching to him at the end of the Monday night sangha, and after a while, I just kind of rambled on, and then he's like, "Because wow, you must be so grateful you have this opportunity to practice." And I was on when we were still at Sandpoint, and I was like, "You've just been listening to me." Very grateful, and not until this past year have I been trying very hard, to be grateful for everything that comes up to work. And boy, every area of this practice comes up at work, for myself, and then what is, offered to me. But to come away, like even at the end of the day, to try to find some gratitude of the lessons it's bringing me, whether I kind of accept it or I can see it at the moment or not, to try to close the day out with that, which is sometimes really difficult. But I just remember him saying that. Oh my God, it was at one of the same points. It was so long ago, and not until this past year do I still remember what he said to me. And now, trying to finally put it into practice. So I appreciate this talk very much, so because it is very much about sometimes seeing the gratitude of it, you're allowing this practice to come forth and practice. So,
That's great. Thank you, Karen. Thanks for sharing that. I can imagine Steve saying that. Thank you. Yeah, and so when I sometimes I just use the word dukkha or suffering kind of globally, but where is there tension? Where are you complaining? If you're up in the middle of the night, what are you worried about? This is the dukkha of work. So it is, and like I mentioned at the beginning, it is an opportunity. It's really diff it's sometimes we can sense that more in retrospect, but suffering can give rise to a kind of confidence. Oh, and we can get very attentive, very interested, very careful. What's actually happening? What's actually happening here? I'm often being called to grow some kind of capacity that isn't strong yet, right? So, I can look back of excruciating days of parenting and can see, oh, I was growing a capacity that is now helpful. Can see that in different work situations as well. So, we can often appreciate it in retrospect, but in the moment, it's a tough sell. So yes, good to have a sense of humor about that. Thank you for bringing that. There was something in the room too.
So two questions. One, they both have to do with meditation. One is that recently I've been having this kind of like pattern of, okay, work thought, family thought. I was getting a little bit frustrated with two things, that, yeah, it's work and family. And the other was that it hasn't been with any deeper feelings. It's just these thoughts come and go, and something feels like it's different. So that's one question. I'll tell you the other question also. The other question is, sometimes it's more like I'm getting these thoughts, and they come very quickly, and they feel as if it's like it's a puzzle. I like solving puzzles. It's like a little situation. And I move on so fast that I, like, when I try to label it, I'm not even sure what this thought was about. And I just move on to the next one. And I try to slow myself down, and it just doesn't materialize. The ideas don't quite form. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if any of these things are recognizable or if you have any thoughts about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to work with thinking, and it sounds like you're kind of exploring and experimenting with different ways to work with thinking. But, you know, often our thoughts will just repeat, you know, anyone noticed, over and over again. And the ones that come back that are obsessed, that can be tending towards obsession or really, really kind of have a relentless quality to them. Then it can be helpful to drop down into the body, and instead of just kind of train spotting our thinking, to really see, okay, what's actually here? Is there a certain kind of emotion or mind state or experience that I don't want to, that I would rather not feel? And I'm kind of using my thinking to get away from it in some way. So sometimes that's happening, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes our thoughts are just fast and repetitive, and there isn't much of a zing to them. So, but often, a lot of the challenges that come up at work can feel really core, you know, because they involve our relationships to other people, they involve our, often a sense of worth or identity. So it's useful to ask oneself, what actually has gotten activated here? What's happening here? What has actually been triggered? What feels tender? What feels like I snagged? Our minds get snagged on certain things, and emotions will be activated. So sometimes that can be helpful to sort of ask those questions. And then I can't remember exactly what was the second one about your thinking. It was, they just kind of flittered away.
They come by and they go away very quickly.
I don't see a problem with that. That's a problem most of us would like to have. Yeah,
so when you're describing the repeating things, it's like a thought crossed my mind. Is this success? Is this success when these repeating thoughts are not coming? Well, I guess this is a good thing. Mm. You know, at some point, the repeating things were the thing that I was dealing with, but it feels like there's still something missing right now.
I would, you know, watching the coming and going of thinking is part of the practice, but it's not all of the practice, right? It's wanting to know our whole, the fullness of our whole experience. Thinking is one part of it, and for most of us, it's the most compelling part of what's happening, is our thinking. So there is some way in which we're disentangling ourselves from over-identifying with our thinking. And so we can ask questions like, what else is happening here? What else is happening here? because it is just one channel of experience. So there is more. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Appreciate all the questions and comments and your own inquiries. I think we have, do we have one more talk this month on this? Is it the 22nd today? Yes, so we have one more. I think it might be Tim, and he'll likely do a discussion next week, more of a discussion. So would encourage you to continue your reflections. And again, from tonight, both on the refraining aspect of wise livelihood, but also in this cultivating aspect, what we're bringing forward. So it's such a rich territory. Okay. Anyone need a ride home? Anyone need a ride? Who's in the room? No? Okay. All right. I remembered even, and no takers. All right. So let's just take a quick moment, and we'll just offer the merit. So no need to do anything fancy with your posture, but we can just incline our minds for a moment. It's the intention that the benefits of our practice be shared. So whatever interest or insight, sense of connection, relief we may experience from our practice, may it be a benefit both to ourselves and to all beings we come in contact with. May our practice be for the benefit of all beings everywhere, without exception. Okay, so thank you for your practice tonight.